Welcome to Health Chat. I'm Lina Khomoudou. On the program today, we will discuss the measles outbreak ongoing currently in Zimbabwe. Our guest is Dr. Alex Ntale-Gasasira, WHO representative to Zimbabwe. But first, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation has released its sixth annual Goalkeepers Report. According to the report, nearly every indicator of the UN Sustainable Development Goals is off track at the halfway point for achieving them by 2030. Despite significant setbacks caused by overlapping global crises, the report underscores opportunities to accelerate progress toward ending poverty, fighting inequality, and reducing the impacts of climate change. It notes a progress in the fight against HIV/AIDS with nearly 60% decline in annual death between 2000 and 2020. This year's report includes best and worst case scenarios for ending preventable infectious diseases and malnutrition, improving access to quality education, increasing access to financial services, and achieving gender equality. In their respective essays, Melinda Fridge Gates and Bill Gates called for new approaches to achieving gender equality and food security. Now, the World Health Organization and partners have launched a roadmap to stop bacterial meningitis outbreaks on the continent by 2030. In a race against time, African countries are being urged to rapidly implement the plan before the start of the meningitis season in January, which runs until June. Meningitis is caused by inflammation of the membranes surrounding the brain and spinal cord. Acute bacterial meningitis can cause death within 24 hours and leaves one in five survivors with lifelong disability. While meningitis type A accounted for 90% of cases and death before 2010, no new cases have been reported since 2017. Experts say fallout from COVID-19 has hampered efforts to eliminate this bacterial infection as a public health threat and could lead to catastrophic resurgences. Meanwhile, Zimbabwe is struggling to contain a measles outbreak that has killed nearly 700, most of them children and young people. Health authorities have been struggling to contain the infectious viral disease since the first case was reported in April. Over 6,000 people have been infected by the virus that causes a rash, cough, high fever, and can be fatal for unvaccinated children. The WHO has activated its emergency response strategy in Zimbabwe to deal with the latest measles outbreak in the Southern African nation. For more insight, I spoke with Dr. Alex Ntale-Gasasira, WHO representative to Zimbabwe.
Zimbabwe is experiencing a measles outbreak that started in one part of the country, in the eastern part of the country. And this outbreak started amongst children predominantly that had not been vaccinated and was predominantly in a community that has traditionally not accepted vaccination. But it soon spread out of that community and has now spread to different parts of the country, which is not totally unexpected because Zimbabwe has had an increased number of unvaccinated children, largely due to the disruptions in the last 2 years due to COVID-19. So it initially was in a vaccine hesitant community, but now has spread out to affect other unvaccinated children across the country.
We are seeing flare-ups of measles outbreak in Zimbabwe, and other countries like Zambia is also experiencing an outbreak. Can you explain to us what measles is and what makes it so difficult to contain it once and for all?
Measles is a viral disease. It's a disease caused by a virus that is very contagious, that easily spreads and mainly affects children that have not been vaccinated. If countries, communities are able to achieve high vaccination coverage, measles can be brought under control. And it would be important for me to highlight that in Zimbabwe, the outbreak that started this year, 2022, is the first outbreak that Zimbabwe is experiencing in 12 years. So for the last 12 years, Zimbabwe had achieved a high enough vaccination coverage to keep measles at bay. Zimbabwe had one of the highest routine immunization coverages. And as we all know, the aim is that for the routine immunization is for children to receive two doses of measles vaccine in their first 2 years of life. So the routine immunization program was achieving this at a very high rate. It is true that Zimbabwe has communities that are reluctant to receive vaccination, to present their children for vaccination. But because these numbers were very low, and the larger proportion of children were being vaccinated, were receiving their vaccines as expected, and Zimbabwe was periodically implementing high-quality measles campaigns, this kept measles out of the country for 12 years. And it was, unfortunately, during the COVID-19 pandemic, where everything was disrupted, routine services were disrupted, the ability of mothers and children to access services was interrupted, that we had, the good immunization performance being reversed. And we now have higher numbers of unvaccinated children that can propagate this illness. And because it's so contagious, that's why we're having this outbreak currently.
So COVID is partly a reason. You also talked about communities that refuse to vaccinate their children. Can you explain to us some of the reasons why?
So we have some communities that for religious reasons are reluctant to have their children vaccinated. Having said that, in the past, there have been successful efforts to reach out to these communities to allay their concerns and to get their involvement and engagement and participation in immunization activities. So again, that regular dialogue and interaction and engagement suffered during the COVID-19 pandemic because of all that we know. So that's one factor. So it's true we have these communities, but we have had successes in previous times in engaging them. Two, of course, with the advent of COVID-19 disease, new vaccines, the COVID-19 vaccines, again, some of the communities, some of the population have unanswered questions. And we, as partners, are working with the authorities in Zimbabwe to reach out to these communities and re-establish that dialogue such that we can answer some of their questions, including some of their questions as around the introduction of the COVID-19 vaccine.
What does the situation look like in terms of numbers?
Currently, about 10% of the children who have been reported and were working, we are very happy that the government of Zimbabwe is doing everything to strengthen surveillance across the country, across all communities, such that the numbers that are reported reflect the true situation. And right now, as we speak, we see that about 10% of the children that have been reported to have measles have died. So that's a fairly high case fatality rate. But we are trying to validate this by doing, comprehensive outbreak investigation to ensure that all the numbers that we are counting are correct. So that is still work in progress. Having said that, again, one of the thrusts of the Zimbabwe outbreak response is to do everything possible to reduce the high fatality rate as together with the rollout of vaccination. This is being done together with vitamin A supplementation and strengthening capacity to manage sick children across the country in the district hospitals, in the health facilities, wherever these children are being reported.
What else is needed, whether it's the community themselves or partners?
The government, together with the health partners, all the partners, including UNICEF, WHO, MSF, Gavi, the donor community, are putting together the resources that are required to ensure high quality vaccination campaign. That is ensuring availability of adequate doses of vaccine, the injections and associated supplies, ensuring strong community engagement across the country, strengthening capacities at subnational, at provincial, district, and health facility level to have high quality planning, training and retraining of the health workers, ensuring that teams have the logistics to go out to reach the communities wherever they are and offer the service, and ensure that the community themselves come out and are comfortable to receive the service.
Vaccine availability has been a challenge. Is there enough doses? How many children are to receive the vaccination?
The initial phase of the response, there has been very strong, mobilization of resources, both from the national government as well as from the partners. And for this initial phase, the vaccination campaign has been limited to the children from 6 months to 5 years. But we are seeing in some of the most affected districts and communities, quite a number of children above 5 years who are affected. What this sort of indicates to us is that we may have to expand the age group that we are targeting for this vaccination campaign to go up to children of 15 years of age, in particular, especially the most affected districts. And that will need additional resources, additional vaccines, additional injectable supplies. And so this is where we will need, solidarity and additional resources from the international community, from the domestic resources. So, yes, we will definitely need additional resources. And we are very grateful to the donors that have already come in, but we will definitely need more. In terms of managing already sick children, again, we are doing our best to build capacity, again, across the country, retraining health workers. As I mentioned to you, measles had not been seen for 12 years in this country, so some of our frontline health workers have to be retrained on how to recognize and manage cases. So again, we are working together with the government to intensify resource mobilization to generate more resources to ensure that we have a comprehensive capacity across the country.
And finally, Dr. Gasasira, what lessons learned can we take from this experience, this particular outbreak in Zimbabwe after 12 years?
The main lesson is that, again, as we respond to emergencies, as we saw in the COVID-19 response, Zimbabwe did a fantastic job in keeping the transmission of COVID-19 to the minimum, really. There was great mobilization. There was a whole of government, whole of society response effort. I think one of the lessons that we can learn is that as we respond to emergencies, we need to concurrently ensure that essential services like immunization get the attention they deserve. Unfortunately, we are now paying the price of some of these services being interrupted during the emergency.
Dr. Alex Ntale-Gasasira, thank you so much. We appreciate your time.
Thank you so much for having me.
That was Dr. Alex Ntale-Gasasira, WHO representative to Zimbabwe. You are listening to Health Chat on Voice of America. It's time for a short break. Don't go away. We'll be right back.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Encounter. Join me and two advocates from the world of politics, public policy, or academia debating critical and controversial issues of our day, bringing depth, perspective, and insight to the world around us. You can listen to Encounter on Saturdays and Sundays, or subscribe to the Encounter podcast. Just go to our homepage at voanews.com and click on podcasts. Also, we love to hear from you. Send an email to encounter@voanews.com or connect with us on Facebook at facebook.com/CarolCastielBOA and follow us on Twitter at CarolCastielBOA. That's Encounter, every Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
Welcome back to Health Chat. We turn now to maternal health. A cesarean section, also known as C-section or cesarean birth, is the surgical delivery of a baby through an incision or cut made in the mother's abdomen and uterus. Medical providers perform a C-section when a natural delivery may put the life of the mother, the baby, or both of their lives at risk. Cases often include difficult labor, high blood pressure, and problems with the umbilical cord. Cesarean sections, however, are performed sometimes for no medical reasons, often upon a mother's request. According to the World Health Organization, cesarean section use continues to rise globally and now accounts for more than 1 in 5 of all childbirth. Experts say access to safe C-section procedures in underserved communities, such as those in Africa, is an effective way to reduce maternal mortality. However, many women die due to a lack of access to the life-saving procedure, bleeding, infection, or errors in the procedure. Dr. Hadiza Abdullahi Usman is a professor of obstetrics and gynecology at the University of Maiduguri Teaching Hospital. She elaborates on the challenges of C-sections and what can be done.
Cesarean section is very, very safe now, and it's very common. Almost every doctor is trained, but not now. There's not even doctors in some countries are even relegating that or encouraging and training lower cadre staff, not just at the level of the doctors, to be able to conduct cesarean section in rural setting. Most people will go, especially in the rural setting, they will go for antenatal care. But when it comes to delivery, they will stay at home and be attended to by untrained traditional birth attendant. Even the trained traditional birth attendant, there's a limit to which she can do. Her knowledge is not that exposed. When the complication will set in, she will not know. So that is why we kept on saying that the safest, the most important means or ways of preventing maternal mortality is the presence of a skilled birth attendant during delivery. So it's becoming very, very safe. But still the issue, maybe lack of awareness is still making, because from, if I should cite the typical example of the challenges we face, even in this teaching hospital now, when you say you want to carry a cesarean section in a woman, you see the relatives dragging their feet. They will tell you that all my generation, all my relatives are delivering vaginally. Why should my wife deliver by cesarean section? We've seen mothers, parents taking away their daughters that they will never have, over their dead body, they will never have cesarean section. But cesarean section is very, very safe now. There are women that can even come on their own and have elective cesarean section on maternal request because they feel that they don't want to go through the pain of labor. But the most important is if when there is need for that cesarean section, especially if you're going for antenatal care and a problem can be identified. Either your baby is not lying the way it should lie, or your pelvis is contracted, or the placenta may even come and cover the vagina, the where the baby is supposed to pass through and come out. And of course, if I have something blocking where I'm supposed to pass through, I have to dislodge that thing that is blocking it. And when you dislodge a placenta, that is one of the causes of bleeding that can make a woman to die. So you can see that we always have an indication, not that a woman will just be sectioned for the sake of sectioning. It's either for in the interest of saving the life of the baby or saving the life of the woman. Cesarean section is quite safe, and it has been shown to reduce maternal mortality and equally infant mortality. Assessing is the availability of the healthcare providers, the hospital setting that can conduct cesarean section, which most of the times we do have, except in the rural setting where they have to be referred early if they realize that there are certain problems that this woman cannot actually make it and have a safe delivery, they do refer them early. But most of the times, some of these things you still have to pay. So it's still boiling down to the cost implications, since most of the times it's still out-of-pocket expensive. And if you're not, that is why we always preach on bad preparedness. God has given you 9 months, so you should be prepared for the worst outcome. And one of the worst outcomes is the possibility of having cesarean section. So the money should be made available. Blood should equally be, who is going to donate blood should equally be sourced for right from beginning. And with the slightest observation that there's a problem, that individual or that pregnant woman should be taken to where she can have safe delivery. So for us to really reduce the number of women that are dying, awareness, education, giving the girl child the requisite education, financial empowerment, support from the family, especially the husband, will go a long way. But most importantly, providing the needed health works, providing the midwives that can stay in the rural setting, and then going to the hospital, and then probably making the services free to some extent.
That was Dr. Hadiza Abdullahi Usman, professor of obstetrics and gynecology at the University of Maiduguri Teaching Hospital. People sifting through waste at Nairobi's Dandora dump are risking severe health issues, including cancer and infertility. The United Nations Environment Programme warns that the dump site poses serious health threats to those working and living nearby. But still, some 10,000 women and children work through the rubbish each day, hoping to find recyclable materials to sell so they can feed their families.
Acrid smoke billows from the mountain of waste at the Dandora rubbish dump in Nairobi. International humanitarian organization Concern Worldwide reports that about 10,000 women, children and a few men scavenge through the piles of rubbish daily. They sift through the waste, most with bare hands, for their livelihood.
We usually look for plastic bottles, carton box, gunny bags, bones and pig food. Yet we do this without protective gloves and gumboots. So we sometimes get cuts from glass.
The health risks go beyond scrapes and cuts. The United Nations Environment Programme, UNEP, warns that air pollution created by the Dandora landfill is a wide range of health risks for both workers and the community nearby. They include skin disorders, cancers, respiratory abnormalities, and blood disorders.
Lead and mercury are heavy metals. And most of the time, the women who are working at the dump site, they are actually inhaling at the same time ingesting these particular heavy metals. It's not only affecting the reproductive health, but it's also affecting the women. And most women are actually ending up with cancer. Remember, mercury is one of the major metals associated with cancer. Lead the same.
Mother of six, Winfred Wanjira, spends her working days filling her sack with recyclable plastics to make enough money to feed her children. Her health is at risk, and she is aware.
Sometimes you might unexpectedly lose your pregnancy, but when you change your environment, you can have a successful pregnancy. However, when you try to change your environment, you may lack work opportunities and your children become hungry. You have no other option but to come back.
So if a woman gets cancer and she's not aware that she has cancer, most of the time, the first thing that is affected is her menstrual cycle. This could be one of the first signs, heavy bleeding. When she has the heavy bleeding and that is irregular, it could be actually an early warning sign that this particular woman is actually having cancer, especially cancer of the reproductive parts.
The United Nations Environment Assembly has initiated this year in Nairobi negotiations for a global agreement to end plastic pollution.
In the resolution that was passed by the UNEA to end plastic pollution, one of the key benefits that we've been able to see from that is with speakers being recognized. So the Intergovernmental Negotiating Committee are required to learn from the experiences of West speakers because they have so much information just by working in the dumpsite. And they're also recognized as people who play an integral part in the formal waste management system. So with this, we are hoping that also countries and Kenya to be among those who are championing for the rights of West speakers and formalized and included in all policy and waste management processes.
Kenya's 2021 Sustainable Waste Management Bill outlines objectives for county governments to improve waste management infrastructure, which observers say is a step in the right direction.
After doctors diagnosed Paula Estrada with breast cancer in 2009, the then 41-year-old Argentine decided she would not only beat the disease, but would do so without losing her long blonde hair to the ravages of chemotherapy.
At her home in Buenos Aires, Paula Estrada, a graphic designer by profession, set about creating a makeshift helmet out of ice packs that, instead of being used for sports injuries, would help keep her scalp cold and ward off hair loss.
My oncologist said, "Well, you are having chemotherapy." But I was happy when I finished treatment. I get emotional about this part. I told him, I can't keep the helmet for myself. I want everyone to have the chance to not lose their hair, just as I had.
The cold from the helmet constricted blood vessels and helped keep the chemotherapy drugs from reaching Estrada's hair follicles. Over a decade later, versions of Estrada's helmet have helped some 60,000 cancer patients in Argentina, as well as Chile, Mexico, Spain, and the United States. The helmet has increasingly been used in Argentina's main hospitals following the Food and Drug Administration's approval in 2017.
The efficacy of the helmet is based on the cold temperature that produces vasoconstriction. Vasoconstriction lowers the amount of drug that gets to the hair follicle, and that helps prevent hair loss.
The helmet must be used from the first chemo session and needs to be kept at -4 degrees Fahrenheit or -20 degrees Celsius and changed every 30 minutes. Maria Angeles Fernandez, a 48-year-old liver cancer patient, says it's worth it and it makes you fight the disease in a different way.
I think the helmet was the key to keeping my mood up. I don't feel anything while wearing it. I get out of treatment, take the helmet off, and live my life like any other person.
Isa Ram, a 64-year-old retiree with breast cancer, says she agrees.
You have to put the helmet in the freezer 2 days in advance. I know it takes some logistics, but it's worth it because it makes you fight the illness differently. You, your children, and your surroundings see yourself differently. So I continue using the helmet.
That's all for this edition of Health Chat. For the latest news and coverage on the coronavirus pandemic, visit voanews.com. Thank you all for joining us, and special thanks to all our affiliate stations throughout Africa for carrying Health Chat. I'm your host, Lino Khumudu, in Washington, with producer Dan Brown. Until next time, take care, stay safe, and strive to make every day a healthy day.
Hello, this is James Barty, Managing Editor and host of VOA's Daybreak Africa show. Join us Monday through Friday at 03, 04, 05, and 0600 hours UTC as we bring you the latest Africa news, features, and sports. You can also be a part of Daybreak Africa through our mail segment by sending your comments to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. Or you can call us on 001-202-205-9942. And when you hear the Voice of America identification, press the number 25 to leave us your message. That's Daybreak Africa at 03, 04, 05, and 0600 hours UTC, right here on VOA Africa.
This is a message in the public interest from VOA Africa.
Hello, I'm VOA health correspondent Linor Modou. The World Health Organization and Africa Centers for Disease Control say we all can help fight the global pandemic by frequently washing our hands or using hand sanitizers. For more information on protecting yourself and others, check with reliable sources such as the WHO and Africa CDC. And remember to listen to VOA for the latest on COVID-19.